presuming, are you finished?
Yeah, I finished my general.
Right. Ms. Grace, I want to talk to you about 3.2.52 and the clarification you provided, saying that O&Ls, it's generally inappropriate, and RCLs, it's generally appropriate. And I struggle to see that distinction between those two policies, because this is a question I asked Mr. Barr some time ago, might even have been Monday, that what the words are anticipated in 3.2.5.2, and how do you interpret it? What does anticipated mean? Foreseen?
Yes.
Accepted?
Not necessarily accepted.
And you could reframe that policy to say within RCLs there may be adverse effects, but they're only acceptable if landscape character is maintained. And it would mean the same thing?
The qualifier is they're only anticipated if the landscape...
Provided that.
Yeah.
It's like, and so I've... And I think Mr. Barr's view was that maintenance of landscape character and visual amenity values is not a no adverse effect position, but equally I struggle with, as I understand it, protecting O&L landscape values is not an absolute no effect position either. So what is the difference in substance between the two of them?
That's the punchline.
Sure. But, well, in my opinion, protect is a much stronger direction than maintain or enhance. What that means in terms of landscape values is kind of a question for the landscape architects, I guess. But I think protect is a stronger hurdle to get past. Anticipated is a much more, what's the word, permissive or enabling. So it's kind of on the positive side of the language you might use in a district plan, whereas for the O&L, it's inappropriate unless, which is kind of more of a negative phrasing, like it's kind of, I don't know if that makes sense, but... The structure and the language for the RCL implies a different outcome to the O&L one, which is worded, uses stronger words in quite a directive way.
Is it just to say it's all in the sizzle, it's not actually in the words?
I think the words are important.
But in terms of... If you break them down individually, it's the impression you get from the words more than what they actually say?
Maybe. How they're structured is important. But protect is really clear, as is maintain and enhance, and anticipated. They're quite strong and clear words, I think.
Can I ask another one about the wording in here? One of the other differences, apart from those ones, is that in the O&L one, it's actually the development, the use, subdivision development, that's inappropriate.
Yes.
Whereas in the other one, it's effects from development that's anticipated. So the first one, I mean, is there anything in that?
Maybe. Just think about that for a minute. Well, yeah, you could argue that that makes the ONL1 stronger again because you almost don't get to the effects consideration, it's just the use, the activities specifically. Whereas the RCL, by focusing on effects, almost provides a bit more flexibility, maybe.
Suppose it comes back to if a development in an ONL has no effects, you will be protecting the
Yeah,
values.
that's true.
You go around in the same circle.
I don't want the words.
And what I want to put to you is that there is an Environment Court case about Port Otago which suggests, which breaks down the word protect and the word maintain, and concludes that maintain is a higher hurdle because maintain requires positive action, whereas protect just means prevent people from doing things. It's clearer when you're talking about biodiversity, where maintenance might require pest management, whereas protecting, you can do nothing and satisfy a protection covenant. But the conclusion of the court was that maintenance was a higher hurdle. And I know that that's not the vibe, because that's why I was interested in the reasoning of the court, because I had the same reaction as you.
Yeah.
And so that's something we'll have to ponder. It might be something you and Ms. Scott ponder as well. Now, in terms of the discussion you were having with Commissioner Dawson, I want to turn it around the other way. And ask you, accepting that there's a whole lot of issues about how you frame it, if you expand the RVZ to RCLs, is there any good reason not to have to provide for the activities that are provided for in a rural visitor zone in RCLs?
My answer to that is no, I think, having been through Chapter 3, I don't think there's a reason not to have an RVZ and an RCL, provided it was actually an RVZ.
Did you say the activities? Did you mean VA and commercial recreation activities?
Correct. And that's why, as I say, I qualified and say there are a whole lot of things, as your discussion with Commissioner Dawson suggests, that you need to qualify or express another way if you do that. But I say I want to look at it. And then if it's a ways and means issue, is there an alternative zoning that provides for those activities in the rural zone RCL?
Not in a permissive way that the RVZ does. You could apply for resource consent under the rural zoning through a discretionary activity consent for all the activities that the RVZ allows for. But unless you go to an urban zone, there isn't an equivalent. Accepting that resort zones are all...
Unless you have a special zone.
Yeah, something bespoke.
Zone.
Yeah.
Discretionary in the rural
yes.
zone.
Yeah.
Presumably this thing in the Waukata Basin zone as well.
Yeah, that's right.
I want to talk to you. Do you restrict yourself to general questions? Or
yes.
I was about to go into the objectives.
Oh, well, that was included.
Okay.
Oh,
yeah. That's fine. going to...
I don't know if I did go into my questions on the phone, but you, where you go?
Page 11.
Of my 42A?
Of your 42A. I was intrigued by your rewording. That, which implied to me that if you could actually find a rural landscape that wasn't sensitive, it wouldn't be suitable for an RVZ.
Say that again.
Because you said your wording are provided for in an RVZ located only in areas of landscape sensitivity that do various things. If you could find an area that wasn't sensitive to landscape, didn't have a landscape sensitivity, if there are any in this district, which is perhaps dubious, but just like the way it's framed suggests an inherent assumption that everywhere is sensitive. Is that assumption correct?
I don't think it's quite that simple, I think. What that does is link the method used to manage landscape values into the objective. If the RVZ didn't use landscape sensitivity, then I wouldn't have suggested that wording. So I would assume, although I'm not a landscape architect, that every landscape has some degree of sensitivity, even if it's low or down at zero. It's a way to assess those values and then protect or maintain or achieve those management outcomes.
And the next question is, this is what we've discussed previously. Do we need to, assuming we agree with your recommendation to expand beyond O&Ls, do we need to provide for the Waukatipu Basin? Because at the moment this is O&Ls and RCLs only.
You're right. The version of the chapter attached to my second rebuttal...
Good answer.
...fixes that up. It takes out reference to rural character landscapes, and so it talks about O&Ls, and then it talks about other landscapes, so that would include the Waukatipu area as well.
Now, I want to talk about 42.21A. Because I marked these up separately and didn't go back and compare them, I'd say if you solve this in rebuttal, just tell me. This is a point I've raised specifically. Generally remote, difficult to see in public spaces. Of course, as I mentioned, I think it was to Mr. Jones, the O&L test is reasonably difficult to see. I think the RCL test is highly visible from public places.
Mm-hmm.
So this is neither one nor the other. And is this one of those things that needs to be separated out? Say, have a different different test to recognise the differences in policy, strategic policy?
Yeah, that's a good question. It may be a case of needing separate ones. I think at the time I thought that difficult to see could encompass not highly visible from public places, and that they're kind of the opposites of each other, if that makes sense. The inverse of each other. But that may not have been the intention of the draft in Chapter 6.
Well, in essence, difficult to see is a higher test than the O&L, and if you think that visible but not highly visible is acceptable in Chapter 6 terms for an RCL, the question would be, why does an RBZ need to have a more stringent landscape test than any other development in an RCL?
Yeah, and that's a good question, a good point. So yeah, it probably is one of those situations where separating it out for each landscape would be more in keeping with that Chapter 6 direction.
And issue I had for you is the discussion in 4.24 about shifting the 46.22 to an enabling focus, and the question I had is whether that's consistent with your recommendation in effect to tighten up the rules with additional standards and for new RBZs.
You're talking about deleting providing and replacing it with enabling?
Correct.
And I think that's part of clarifying the policies and how they relate to the rules, in that it's permitted and controlled activity status that implements this part of the policy, and I think enabling as a policy direction better supports that. It goes together with switching, ensuring that, to restricting, which I think clarifies and tightens up the next level, and then you end with a void. So it's kind of, when you view them as a whole, I think it makes more sense.
I suppose the question is, that you've said to us that that new sites should only be allowed if there's a tighter coverage limit, and I think certainly the view of the landscape architects is that they would prefer that with the existing sites, but there's no scope to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Is it appropriate against that background be recommending that the objective moves more towards emphasising the enabling function, which creates an inconsistency between the two? Like, I'm well aware that Planning 101 is that objectives drive policies and policies drive rules, but the end result is an inconsistency between the two, it seems. So I'll put that.
I think I understand. I'm not sure that that's the providing for or the enabling that causes that inconsistency. The rules have controlled activity status for the notified RVZs, and that's what's proposed for the new RVZs as well. So the lack of the coverage standard, that inconsistency is in the rules and standards as opposed to in the policy. I guess I'm saying I think it would, that leaving it as providing for, I don't think solves that problem.
Which it comes back to Ms. Birch's submission that the ground rules for this zone need to be clearer because in her view it's too permissive.
Yeah.
So it's the purpose and the objectives. So. How is staff accommodation treated in the plan? Is that a separate activity?
It's linked to, what does it say? Just find the
recreational activities rule, I think.
Yes, so there's one rule, 46.4.3, for activities that reads commercial recreational activities and on-site staff accommodation is permitted.
You think that it's already provided for within the definition of visitor accommodation?
That's a good point. And the answer is potentially yes. I'll just perhaps look up the definition.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
So visitor accommodation includes on-site staff accommodation.
The reason I'm going there is what I was actually talking about, the definition of activities, on the face of it, unless it's separately defined, and I haven't checked whether it is, staff accommodation is a residential activity.
Yes, and that's why it's noted as an exception, I think, in the non-complying rule for, so rule 46.4.13, residential activity except as provided for, and rule 46.4.2, which is visitor accommodation, and 46.4.3. So
gotcha.
I think the reason on-site staff accommodation is with commercial recreation is because for the situation as if there's not VA on the site, but you want staff accommodation with your commercial recreation activity, then you can't then rely on the VA definition to have on-site staff accommodation.
Gotcha. I haven't checked, but is there a policy specific to staff accommodation?
Yes.
Script.
46.217, avoid residential activity within the rural visitor zone with the exception of enabling on-site staff accommodation ancillary to commercial recreation and visitor accommodation activities.
So that all works.
Doesn't it help coverage?
Well, true. Which is why they want to amend the rules. That's all I have, thank you. Mr. Hill.
Thank you. Following a similar theme, I share the same, I suppose, concerns, Commissioner Dawson. And can I just take you through those objectives and policies? Because I imagine through the reply they'll come back, and I know it's really difficult on a hop to kind of look at wording, but can I just pose some things to you and we go through it? So firstly, the objective, and it's partly what Commissioner Chairman Robinson put to you. So this is the rural visitor zone. The first objective is that, and it is provided for through rural visitor zone located only in areas of landscape sensitivities. And I just question whether you even need those words at all, because it's A and B which seem to be the significant component. So those activities provided where those other things are met, is a comment. flows into that first policy. Oh, so this is in your second rebuttal.
Yep.
Statement.
Yep.
At policy 4621A, areas identified as the zone shall, and we've got the generally remote location difficulty, etc. It kind of tells you what the zone is, and I wonder what the role of that policy is, unless, and I don't agree with this, but unless it's somehow to bat off private plan changes that come along, but this policy sits here, it's supposedly to an a understanding of the zone and decision making, and it just seems to be a statement of what the zone is. So I couldn't quite see the purpose of it. It doesn't take you anywhere, in my view. The next policy is that one we talked about, provide for innovative and appropriate. And I don't disagree with that, but I just wonder how innovative design is provided for here. As I said, I don't disagree with the concept, but I'm just not sure how it flows through into the rules. 46213, encourage the enhancement of nature conservation values. And I just, again, it's that word encourage. I mean, and again, how does that, you know, again, if these are consenting, I can understand that you might want those, but I think encouragement's not very strong. If this is about sort of landscape sensitivity, whether it should be ensure or something, I think a different word might need to be contemplated. 46215, again, is that sort of similar thing. It talks about not degrading the level of amenity of the surrounding area. I mean, again, it just invites a holdover. What is the level of the amenity? What is the existing amenity? What is the surrounding area, particularly if this gets expanded into the outside the OMLs? I think it just, and again, I just wonder what it's actually adding. I understand the concept, I just don't think the words deliver it. Can I take 46217, and it's the one you just talked about, avoid, and I understand that, you're trying to avoid residential activity. But then I read it in relation to the one above, 46215, ensure that any land use area not otherwise anticipated, so I read the SA residential, protects the landscape value. So I wonder whether it kind of gives you an indice, okay, in a consent, someone's applying for it, it says you have to avoid it, but I then argue that I've satisfied that policy above. So I just read the two policies that run together seem to be slightly contradictory to me. Come to the next set of objectives, which I'm less concerned about that. It comes across, for example, dropping down again, it's the one that we were having a discussion with Mr. Robbins about, protect, maintain and enhance. In 46222, land use development particular building shall protect, maintain or enhance. Does someone get to pick? I mean, which one would apply? So again, I by inserting the word protect in there, I think sort of changed the whole focus of that policy. 46223. Again, I think it's in my view, it suffers from that same issue I've talked about amenity. It says maintain open landscape character where it is open at present. And again, I wonder whether that, with the expanded RCL type, how that might get interpreted, what actually is open. It just invites a whole series. And then lastly, 46224, ensure that the location direction of lights does not cause excessive glare and avoids unnecessary degradation. So it's sort of assuming that there will be some degradation, but someone just needs to prove it's necessary or unnecessary. And I just again whether I understand what the concept's trying to do, I just wonder whether that really delivers it.
That just the unnecessary or the excessive as well?
Well, it's does not call it excessive glare, and again I think it, again it just invites what is excessive and avoids unnecessary degradation. So it's already accepting that some degradation is appropriate. And I'm wondering whether, for example, in the ONLs and some of these remote locations, whether it does need to be any degradation. I think it just invites policy assumes there will be some.
Mm-hmm.
For the commissioner's benefit,
yeah.
I should note that some of these last ones have come straight out of chapter 6.
And I suppose what I'm going to say is it might not be scoped for some of these things, but as I was reading through them, sorry, thank you for that, I was looking at how this all hung together. Sorry,
yeah.
Ms. Scott's smiling as well. She's thinking, we can't go there. But anyway, thank you very much for indulging me.
And Unnecessary was designed to cover aircraft navigation lights on the tops of hills.
Oh, right.
which are by definition poking upwards.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
Commissioner McLeod.
Oh no. Oh. Not delving into the sphere of fight atmosphere.
I think that's a no. So I think we're on to the RVZ rezoning chapters of your evidence, Ms. Grace. Rezoning requests. Where does that start?
Section 8.
Commissioner Dawson.
Have you got an order that you want?
The only order in the 42A report, start with Skipper's, which is the Mills and Maligan's investments.
Where are you looking at the list?
On page 29.
Could let you know that Maligan's, if that's when you start with, is section 9 of the 42A and section 3 of the second rebuttal statement.
I think if I need you to point me to them, I'll ask.
Yep.
Otherwise, because I'll. No, you've picked up Mr. Jones's. Comments about the sensitivity mapping and the size of the zone, as I understand it, as I recall it.
Yeah.
And the fact that there's no hazard risk assessment,
mm-hmm.
So we can't, you can't give full effect to the regional policy statement or the PDP chapter 28. So that's your main concern, isn't it, at the moment, is this lack of any hazard risk assessment.
Yes.
And you've also pointed out that there's no scope for residential activities in the submission.
Yes.
So my questions are, what about servicing that site? And my second question is, what about transport and traffic safety? Has Mr. Powell looked at the servicing of the site? I don't think so.
No, he hasn't.
But he answered the question to me about scale, because I sort of put that to him because it was about the Gibson Valley site.
Mm-hmm.
But he indicated generally that if it's small scale, the sort of scale that you might accept for a resource consent, say in a rural zone,
mm-hmm.
but it's being done by way of a zone, that he would be happy with the normal requirements and consents, say from ORC, for on-site water and on-site sewage. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, that's right.
For Maligan's, I mean. Would that apply to Maligan's?
Yes, it would, yeah.
Okay. But one thing that struck us driving in there on a wintry day is that it's quite a narrow road in places.
It is, yeah.
And there are a range of commercial recreation activities in there at the moment and a bit of residential development. But not, as I'm aware of, any significant visitor accommodation. But we haven't got any traffic assessment about for traffic safety on that road of having an RVZ of the scale anticipated by the zone,
because
I don't think they're asking for much more than that, on the site. So what, where did you get to with that in your mind?
It comes back to the scale, being the rules contain a limit on group size for commercial activities and the building size limit for built development. So any kind of larger scale requires more specific consideration through the consent process. The skipper's road, it's not, a council doesn't maintain it like a normal road as you'd expect. It kind of is part of the character of the area in a way. That's right.
I totally agree with the character. It's fine.
So I think
the professionality of the driver.
I mean, I'm not used to those roads, so I could overreact.
Oh well, yeah. I mean, I've only done it once myself, and I wouldn't like to do it again in a hurry. But I think that the limited scale that can occur, it reduces the traffic kind of impact if anything greater was being proposed. I think we might have a different opinion of it.
So say it had a building of 500 square metres as visitor accommodation, which it could do as of right, controlled activity, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really to do with the outside of the buildings. I notice you've added in, design and layout of site access on site car park. So that's really just the site access. Wouldn't really be able to use the controlled activity for the building to require an upgrade part of the Skipper's Road.
No.
But if there was a 500 square metre visitor accommodation, I've no idea how many people that could hold, and if there are people that are coming and going every day or every 2 days or something, I've no idea how many traffic movements a day that might lead to. But we've already had Mr. Ross to say that 18 additional people at whatever that other one's called, Matakori, is unsafe.
Because of one...
One corner.
Of one corner.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I know you haven't recommended approval for this site, but I suppose I'm just... Are we overreacting on this traffic thing? Or do you think that with a control on 30 persons per group for commercial recreation and a 500 square metre building, that... there's no need to assess the impacts of traffic safety?
That was my view. I could take some advice and come back to you on that if you'd like.
I think that would be helpful.
I think it would be. Mm. I think from my perspective, Skipper's was probably the most notorious road, certainly in the district, if not the entire country.
You're not even allowed to take rental cars in there much, are you? And yet you're sort of opening it up now for people to come and go.
I guess the setting for the current operations, as I understand it, is that it's controlled through busing people in, and it's not encouraged for individuals to drive. I can see that point.
And I don't think there is. I'm not sure, but my understanding is that there isn't sort of a lot of overnight bulk, albeit small bulk, visitor accommodation in there. It's more the commercial recreation activities, which do come and go often with transport provided as part of the activity.
Yes, so picking up your suggestion, I think it would be good, in anticipation that we will be raising it with submitter.
Yeah.
Who hasn't equally hasn't provided any traffic evidence as to whether it's an issue and what the answer is if it is.
Mm-hmm.
If you could respond, please.
Thank you.
Excuse me, what would be the timing again for me to
that? As part of your reply.
Reply, okay, thanks.
Okay, so that's my question about Maligans. Do you want to go through all of, given there are so many sites, do you want to ask if anyone else for questions on Maligans before we move in?
I feel I need to defend the road.
Defend the council's maintenance of the road.
Wouldn't the...
Sounds like a conclusory question.
Would the condition of the road be a limiting factor on people that drive it?
After the first time.
There's lots of chipping from the sidelines, so we'll leave the commissioner to ask his question.
You know, given that one of the corners was named after a team of horses that took the stuff in there, I do wonder. No, it's all good. Having ridden down the road and appreciated it as the thing of beauty that it is, I'll leave it for the further information and the discussion.
Commissioner Hill?
Thank you.
Well, in that case. Mungwira.
So just one point I would make with regard to the road. You did mention Manukau, that's 100 kilometre an hour environment versus the Skipper's Road, which potentially is not 100 kilometre an hour environment.
I don't think it's speed restricted.
I challenge you to get close.
I understand that. Mungwira. I don't think I need to ask you any questions. I think you've taken up Mr. Jones's concerns about the site being too big, needing to define more discrete areas for development, the level of development hasn't been assessed, building coverage hasn't been assessed, and no scope for residential.
That's right. One thing I'll mention is that the submitter has approached us to discuss their site requirements. Nothing's been agreed or confirmed or progressed to a point that it's worth presenting anything to you, but we're kind of looking at if there's a way to deal with the size of the site in terms of scale and intensity and site coverage, so it may be that the submitter has something to present to you.
It's a work in progress.
That's 6 months.
Don't
hear that very often.
That's good.
Mr. Hill?
I'm sure that Mungwira will have something to present to us.
Yeah. He's keen.
He's keen.
Right. Corbridge?
Oh, wow.
Corbridge, number two.
We've heard from Mr. Powell, we've heard from Mr. Jones. Do you, in terms of the scale of development, in particular the residential and visitor accommodation development proposed for this site, the workers' accommodation really being residential and the visitor accommodation potentially being used for residential some of the time, given the numbers involved, do you see that as being an urban scale of development or fitting within the spectrum of what one might expect in a rural area?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that over the last few days. There's a definition of urban development in the plan. I'm not sure if you've seen it yet or not.
It's the duck test, but it looks like a duck. quacks like a duck.
We have. I don't know.
It is a duck.
Yeah, something like that. So it has to be not rural,
not rural
in character. That's a good start. One thing that definition offers is reliance on reticulated services.
And Mr. Jones has said that he would expect that.
Yes.
That
so
would be necessary.
Yeah. So I think that part of it points towards urban scale. I don't think the site as a whole could be defined as urban development. But the workers' accommodation possibly would be. I'm not sure that the visitor accommodation bit would. I know I haven't had an awful lot of time to come to grips with all of the information in the Corbridge submissions, but I understand there's more building separation and green space and that kind of stuff around the visitor accommodation than for the workers.
Not
accommodation.
All of it. Some of it is fairway
villas
or sort of type thing.
Yeah.
But there's some medium or high density residential areas around the lake, which is called medium density, high density. Sort of units.
Yes. You're right. Yeah. You're right. It's definitely leaning towards that urban scale. It's not rural entirely. So I think it kind of sits somewhere in the middle, slightly more towards the urban end.
We go back to the, if it looks like a duck.
Call it a duck, yeah. Yeah.
For me? Yes, certainly for you.
Just keep going, sorry, I'm like, you and I'll come back.
Because it would be fair to say that, and you've mentioned Corbridge is seeking is perhaps better described as some type of special zone. Do you have a special zone in mind? This is in your rebuttal.
Yeah, the special zones are kind of one-offs, kind of the way the resort zones are. What I know for sure is that it's not RVZ, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It kind of could fit in that resort definition that's in the plan, perhaps. That would require particular attention to that residential development proportion. But otherwise, yeah, the special zones are, there's not really one of those that you'd plonk this into.
So, we're not the business, are we in the business of creating special zones just so that an application can?
No.
Back to the duck. Thank you.
I mean, do you, what's your sort of summary take on whether a zone of this nature is consistent, well, a development of this nature, provisions for development of this nature, are consistent with the zone purpose and the objectives and policies for this RV zone? Where do you see the main differences between what is anticipated through the zone purpose, the objectives and policies for the RV zone, and Corbridge's proposal?
Sure. I think one of the key differences is with policy 46.217 to avoid residential activity. I think it goes beyond that.
Definitely not avoided.
Yeah, that's right. And as things stand with the evidence of Mr. Jones, it also doesn't meet either of the objectives or in the other policies that relate to
the landscape
management. Yeah. It doesn't really fit with the new policy I recommended, 46.21A. It's not remote. Some parts of it are not difficult to see.
It's not difficult to see.
I'm that policy's got difficult to see in it, so it wouldn't, not all the areas
yes.
would meet that.
Yeah.
And I think it's not entirely clear yet whether it is largely comprised of the lower landscape sensitivity areas.
But it could be.
It could be, yeah, that could be. What else have we got?
Is there anything in the policies about sort of discrete, limited and scale, or is that just in the zone purpose?
It's definitely in the zone purpose.
Limited scale and intensity.
There's one particular policy that relates to that in terms of commercial recreation activities. 46215 is to ensure that group size, nature and scale of commercial recreation activities do not degrade the level of amenity. So that does talk about nature and scale for commercial recreation.
But there's no policy about the built form being limited in scale and efficiency.
I'll just read this one before I read it out loud. Yeah, 46221 talks about consolidating built form in the lower landscape areas. And then controlling design height. And yeah, the following policies are about making sure built development meets the landscape outcomes, which can extend to managing scale and its intent, I guess, if that's necessary to maintain the character.
But it doesn't, none of them point you and say this is a limited scale and intensity zone. You know, you need small numbers of buildings.
You're right. That's clearly in the purpose and not as clear in the objectives and policies.
In terms of the other aspects regarding the rural visitor zone, would you say that this zone the Corbridge proposal is there to, whatever the words are, enable access for people to enjoy the district's landscapes?
That's an interesting one and something I was just thinking about in my rebuttal, and I've got one paragraph in there which I'll just find. Yeah, 4.8 of my second rebuttal statement. It would provide access to an RCL because it's an RCL landscape. One thing that occurred to me that I tried to express in that paragraph is that one thing that sets the Corbridge proposal apart from the other RVZ rezoning requests and the existing notified RVZs is that its intent, as I understand it, is to provide access to a modified golf course landscape. The other RVZs provide access to the landscape as it stands, if you like. The Skipper's one will provide access to the Skipper's ONL, even the Heron, which is also an RCL, makes use of the site's current character without needing to change it to provide access to something different to what's there at the moment. And that's, I'm not sure it was the intent of the RVZ to extend to that situation.
Well, if you look at 331A, where it all stems from, if the wording is that activities, recreation and tourism activities, that enable people to access and appreciate the district's landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think in the context of the strategic directions and the wording that's used, that's intended to mean a golf course, or is it intended to mean The wider landscapes.
Yeah, I don't think it means a golf course. I think it means the landscape kind of...
The natural landscape.
Yeah, I'm reluctant to say unmodified or natural because a lot of the ONL even is farmed and that's obviously modified. But the intention isn't to create a new landscape and provide access to that, which I think the golf course element kind of does.
Just interrupting you then. Standard legal interpretation, as per the Interpretation Act, read plural as singular and reverse. Singular includes plural. I think it includes the reverse. This says landscapes plural. If it was just one landscape, corporate is large, but is it a landscape?
It's part of a landscape. It's part of the RCL, and that's the perspective I've had, I guess, when I've considered that for the other RVZs, proposed ones. It's not just the specific site; it's its surrounds as well.
So, could I play the devil's advocate and say that if you were, say, a visitor coming from Tokyo or London? Golf tour by having access to the golf course, does that give you access to the wider landscape?
I've been trying to think about this. If you were on the edge of the Corbridge site, then maybe it would. Or if you're right in the middle, you wouldn't necessarily. I might be overstepping the mark. I'm not a landscape architect, but if you're right in the middle of the site, surrounded by a golf course development, I guess you could potentially be anywhere. Apart from your, like I say, I'm not the landscape architect. Your views out of the site, But compare it to Heron, for instance, where you would be accessing a rural environment that looks the same as the site next to it does. There's definitely a distinction.
I'm not trying to be facetious, but we do regularly have visitors to our district
who
get off a bus in Lake Wanaka, which is in the way now, walk as far as Ely Point, and for them that's an absolute wilderness experience.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you can, and I'm just asking.
I think it's a valid thing to ask, and I think we possibly all have slightly different opinions. But I mean, Mr. Jones is talking about golf courses not being unusual in rural landscapes, but it's what goes with the golf course that makes a difference, I think he was saying. And this one comes with quite a lot of built development, including a little workers' village. So, I don't think it's what the RVZ intended.
Yeah. Okay, that's all my questions on Corbridge.
Likewise, they've covered.
I indicated in my second rebuttal I hadn't had time to go through all of the rules that were in Mr. Corby's evidence. I have looked at them. It's late. So I have since had a closer look at them. And I've got a few comments on them I've kind of scribbled down, including trying to understand if they're all in scope or not. I'm not sure if you wanted to ask me any questions about that or give you feedback on that, or if you were of a mind to grant it, then I would take that up in a reply or something.
I think that if you have I think you need to save them for reply. I think that the Corbridge team might be quite upset effectively giving us further rebuttal at this point.
Yeah. That's cool.
I'm done on the Corbridge.
Gibson Valley Station.
Has everyone else asked
yes,
all
yes,
to get?
Yes, they're okay. Good to go.
Now, Gibson Valley Station, I think I've asked Mr. Jones about the developable, the primary developable areas that were shown on Mr. Mills' plans, which Mr. Jones supports as being an additional layer of management.
Yes.
Have you provided for that? I mean, I'm sorry, it's getting late for me too. Have you provided for that in the rules? Because you're recommending rules for Gibson Valley.
No. Right. Let me just find Gibson Valley.
I don't think you do.
No. I'm pretty sure that I said it wasn't necessary. Oh yeah. Here we go. That the landscape sensitivity was enough. It was interesting though listening to your discussion with Mr. Jones about that earlier today.
There were definitely some of the lower landscape sensitivity areas that he thought weren't appropriate for development.
Yeah.
Some of the higher ones, the top one on the southwest.
Yes.
And
so
yeah, and those
and
the little bits.
But he was happy with the areas Mr. Milne identified.
Yeah. So and yeah. So what I've recommended doesn't quite match that, because what I've recommended would allow the controlled development in all of the lower landscape sensitivity. So it may be that a little bit more refinement is warranted in this case.
Yes. Well, I think that would be consistent with your landscape architect's evidence.
Yeah, 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 yeah. It wasn't, we hadn't talked specifically about
it. That's right.
That
there's
bit.
Lots to do. But the other thing that was more of a concern to me was, backing up, you have mentioned reducing the extent of the zone, though, haven't you?
I have.
And that was consistent with Mr. Jones as well, and it also removed one of the hazard areas.
Yes, that's right. And just looking at the line too, you could slightly amend the line to remove that other lower area that wasn't appropriate.
The lower area of lower.
The one that's up high.
Okay. But the other thing was of more concern was Mr. Rossiter and his outstanding concern regarding road upgrading at the state highway intersection, especially if it wasn't subdivision.
Yes. When I read Mr. Smith's evidence, and I did discuss this with Mr. Smith, my understanding wasn't that he was opposed to it, but that he was highlighting issues that may arise in the future. One of the discussion points I had with Mr. Smith was about the scale of development that might happen on the site if it was rezoned, and I expect I wasn't as clear as I could have been perhaps about what that scale was. I remember talking to him about the 500 square metre building, and then we had a discussion about commercial recreation activities that might come to the site, and I'm trying to remember our conversation, but I'm not sure I mentioned the 30 person limit when I talked to him about that side of the activity. So having read his written statement and gone through my rebuttal, I was of the view that the scale of what is proposed for this site would not trigger those traffic implications immediately, if you like, that the level of development kind of wouldn't get to that point automatically, and it probably would be a development that required consent as a RD activity, I think it would probably be.
RD, and yep. RD doesn't, and the RD doesn't include traffic.
I thought it did.
You've added it in somewhere. Maybe
the controlled activity building meta includes design and layout of site access, on-site parking, manoeuvring and traffic generation. So traffic generation,
So for the controlled activity, which is for the building, would that, because we discussed that in relation to skippers, would that allow you to take a road upgrading contribution or require upgrading at the intersection of Resters Road or whatever it is?
No, I don't believe it would.
And then, so the other triggers then become the scale of activity, and so the building size one is 46.52, which is an RD which doesn't cover
46.52
road upgrading.
Building size. The commercial recreation activity 46.56 for groups larger than 30 includes transport and access as a meta for an RD.
Where's that?
It's 46.56 in the standards table, one page 46.8.
Transport and access.
Which is if you flip over the page.
So that be added into, because imagine if it's a visitor accommodation, greater than 500, it's a big lodge.
Yeah.
Hotel, whatever. I mean, there's no limit on scale once you're into the RD. Should traffic and access be added, and transport and access be added in there?
Yes, it probably should.
Given that you're recommending approval, recommending that we include the Gibson Valley Zone.
Yes. Yeah. I'm just looking now at the list of metas of control for the controlled one and the list for the RD metas, and you would expect them to be.
Does that solve the problem that Mr. Rossiter identified, that there may not actually be a transport solution?
Not directly, but I guess as an RD activity where you have to consider transport effects, that would include an assessment on the transport network, I guess, and you could, if the scale of the activity they proposed was going to reach that trigger point, you could decline that consent. It might need stronger policy direction to achieve that outcome.
The question I pose is leaving it to consent consistent with the, given that this is a traffic safety issue, is that consistent with the, what I would call the hard line that's been pursued on natural hazards, which has been very precautionary?
I don't think it's an inconsistent approach. We have the information we need for transport. We don't have the information yet for hazards, so that makes a difference. We can make an informed decision for the transport, but can't entirely yet for the hazards.
But Mr. Rossiter is saying that you don't have the information about a solution at this intersection.
Oh, about a solution. Yeah, yes.
I mean,
yeah,
he's
but he's
saying it may not be possible.
Yeah, sorry. I mean, he's. We have the information about the problem, I guess, is what I meant, not necessarily the solution.
Like the chairman, I'm concerned that most of the times where one of your witnesses has said, well, we haven't got a solution here, or either we don't have the information, or I don't agree with what the other expert has said, then you've taken a cautious approach. And,
yep.
And whether it's in the settlement zone or here, Arthur's Point here, you've said, well, we can't allow this because this is a rezoning.
Yeah, you're right. In
but here, a sort of almost contrary to the advice of your own witness, we're saying, well, we're saying, oh, we'll leave it to a subsequent resource consent. Now, I understand what you're saying, that subsequent resource consent kicks in at a reasonably small scale, but I don't think we've got traffic information in front of us that says that even below that small scale, it's going to be fine, and that there is a solution once an application comes in over that scale.
Yeah, and that's fair enough, and my discussions with Mr. Smith led me to a slightly different conclusion than I might get to having heard Mr. Rossiter speak today.
Then that's understandable. You've had a sudden change in witness, which is the way it is.
But in that situation, it does kind of force me to reconsider that a little bit.
Or talk to Mr. Ross, sorry.
Yeah.
See where you get to.
Yeah.
I don't have anything else on GPZ. Any gentlemen? I think we're at lock limit.
I think we've got the problems before us here, clearly enough. We've got Ms. Gilbert's recommendations that the sensitivity work hasn't been done sufficiently. We don't have the mapping done adequately. And there hasn't been adequate assessment of the level of development that the proposal wants. You've said that one residential unit with a targeted policy would be okay because this is consistent with what would be allowed as a discretionary activity under the rural zone, so you're bringing it within that envelope from rural through to RV. And then we've also heard from Mr. Bond, I think, that he still had an outstanding concern about hazard on the the homestead block. Which where he recommended an area be identified not for development, and as far as I can see, that hasn't been put forward yet by the submitter. So is there anything else outstanding?
No, I think that's a good summary.
Yeah. Anyone?
Nothing for me. Nothing for me. Like how we a holiday park.
I just have a new heading. So, we have Ms. Gilbert's recommendations, similar sort of theme from Loch Linney. I mean, quite a lot more work needs to be done to refine the landscape assessment and the provisions and the location of development in order to come within the sort of methods and approach used in the RBZ, and also to ensure protection of the outstanding natural landscape in that site. She's changed her view a little bit on glamping and whether if they're there all year they should be exempt from the rules. I would ask you to think very carefully about how one might define glamping.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have thought it's generally understood. I mean, people vaguely understand, but I don't think it would stand up to scrutiny.
Yeah.
That's a sort of small amount. In this location, is this an area where you think if we were inclined to approve it, that some form of refined mapping might be needed in order to direct the location of development if large areas did end up being found to be low landscape sensitivity?
It definitely would need some more refined mapping to be able to meet Ms. Gilbert's recommendations.
A bit like the Mungawira Camp Hill Road one.
Yes. Yeah.
So the bigger issues with this one is, does it fit with the purpose and objectives and policies of the RBZ?
Mm.
Is it remote?
Is it
generally remote, even in terms of however you might define that?
No.
Is it a bit remote?
Not really.
It's right up against an urban area.
It is, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it does, it is an O&L.
It is.
And people who stay there are accessing and enjoying the landscape.
Yes.
The lake and the O&L and the surrounding area.
Yeah.
It mightn't be necessary for them to do that. In other words, they could, if they stayed in the
Hawea,
they could also enjoy the same. But as you said earlier, necessary may not be the test.
Yeah.
Is it discreet, limited in scale, intensity? I mean, it could be, I mean, maybe 31,500 square metre buildings aren't, but it could be constrained.
Confined.
And it could possibly be constrained. I think Ms. Gilbert thinks that it's possible to constrain it so that it does meet the landscape, protect the landscape values of O&L. So how do we reconcile, on the one hand, it meeting some of the tests but not being remote?
This is a tricky site, I think, in terms of zoning, in that it has a current zone over most of it that suits it, being the open space camping ground. I'll forget its full name now. Yeah, because it is publicly owned reserve, and that does set it apart from the others. That zoning of open space went through the stage two hearings, and it was decided that was an appropriate zone for that site, and I don't disagree with where they got to for that. The only comment in comparing the camping ground and the RVZ is that the RVZ perhaps manages landscape in a different way with the landscape sensitivity, and the open space zone doesn't do that. But I did discover recently the camping ground lease with the council requires them to get approval for the works that they do, and there's also a requirement that includes removing trees. So they can't remove trees unless council provides approval for that. So the camping ground zone does make sense given it's an open space reserve. There's also the privately owned land that's currently zoned rural.
I'm sure we'll hear from the submitter that they want an integrated zone for their site.
Yeah, and I can understand that. Yeah, if the camping ground zoning was changed to RVZ, it would be an anomaly for a council-owned reserve, and it would kind of change that overall approach in the zone. But because that zone is intended for publicly owned land, and there's an objective that states that, it doesn't suit the rural zoned land.
That was in the decision.
Yeah. So RVZ could match the privately owned bit, but not the northern bit, because Ms. Gilbert doesn't recommend the northern bit. I'm not sure that helps the burdens in terms of having a consistent zoning.
No, like having open space camping ground over the publicly owned bit, and
RVZ.
Especially once if we agree with Ms. Gilbert that to shrink the developable area,
yes,
it would end up being pretty much back on the camping grounds. I
understand
because
that's who
she's saying it should be focused around the area where the existing development is.
Yes.
Which is
the existing camping ground. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. But, if you put aside all of Ms. Gilbert's concerns and just think about whether or not this is an appropriate site for an RBZ.
Yeah.
Given your discussion with me earlier about remote and generally remote and a bit remote, but also meeting these other requirements, do you think this is a site that fits with the purpose and the objectives and policies particularly, as you've recommended they be amended, for an RBZ?
No, not entirely. It triggers some, but not all of the characteristics of an RBZ, I think. And the main issue's been the remoteness and the difficult to see side of things.
That's all my questions on Pawea.
Can I just query the last, very last comment you made? If the council has a independent control over clearance of trees on the Lakewood side, and Ms. Gilbert's advice is there needs to be a landscape buffer on the roadside, will it be difficult to see, or reasonably difficult to see, in terms of the Chapter 6 policy?
Well, you can see it already, I think. When I did my site visit, not necessarily from the road or the highway, but in my site visit, I went into Hawea to where the kind of above the lake little reservey areas are and parked up there, and you get a clear view of the campground. So its current visibility might not change.
Because where you're talking about the potentially expanding is on the roadside.
I don't know if it's just on the roadside. So the RVZ zoning could go on the embankment, you mean?
So what you're thinking of in terms of difficult to see is from Hawea Township?
Yes. Yep.
Because it's not a complete tree cover along the lakeside.
No, it's a... I think Ms. Gilbert described it as park-like, like it's got...
permeating.
Yeah. So you can see tents and the buildings, current buildings might be a little bit more obscured, but you can see into the site.
That's all I had. Gentlemen?
I'm good, thanks.
Okay.
Now, just a minute. Barn Hill. Oh, sorry, we're still going. Here we are. That's right. I thought you said we're wrapping up.
No,
we've got some more sites.
Yes, we've got a lot more sites. You called me once, but...
No, that's right.
Okay. You're too keen.
No, I...
So, Matakari now.
So on this site, in terms of the traffic issues here, what's your view on that traffic issue? Is it enough to make the rezoning inappropriate?
I think that it is. The traffic advice seems quite clear that there's a safety issue, and that's quite a large safety issue already. And as I think the panel's questioning drew out, that even at the moment, it's bad enough at the moment that a small increase would be too much.
F, you've added in.
Oh, yep.
So what was that number, please?
Oh, so many copies. 46, I've got it here, 46.46F.
46.46F.
Yes, so that's the... you've added in manoeuvring and traffic generation. So that's... So you hadn't intended... I mean, you've said in relation to both the Skippers and the Gibson Valley side that you didn't think that the wording you've added in about manoeuvring and traffic generation and on-site access would be enough to put a condition on regarding upgrading of a whole road, such as Skippers, or even part of a road, or the intersection between Rester Road and the State Highway. But is that actually what you're intending by adding those words in there? Were you more looking at on-site?
It's related to on-site.
Yes, it says on-site parking, manoeuvring and traffic generation. Is that what you're meaning?
Yeah, I guess traffic generation extends a little bit beyond the site,
yes.
And access kind of does as well. Like the car parking is obviously within the site, but it's those activities associated with the site. I think my comment earlier is that it couldn't require financial contributions for upgrades, so it can only come through subdivision. It's possible a condition on a consent, or is it? Probably can't apply off-site, can
no,
it?
No,
but
Can't owned.
Yeah.
Can't have a condition that requires the consent of a third party.
That's right.
But
could make it a condition precedent.
So, but even so, just going to the merits of popping in something about access, manoeuvring and traffic generation, is the scope to add those words in without...
While declining the submission?
Yes, if the Matakari site is not approved.
I think there is, because I think the rural zone has something similar. I'll just hang on a minute. Oh, wait, this is rural living.
Oh.
Rural lifestyle. Sorry, I'm just, there's
you
lots.
Could, you could come back.
Lots of rules. I think the scope, maybe I should come back before I say something that isn't quite correct.
Okay. That's me.
Question, I know the traffic concern, I understand that. Question is, I have is that currently the site is zoned rural lifestyle.
Yeah.
Is that appropriate site for what the is that appropriate zoning for what the site is being used for?
No, I don't think so. I do think that RVZ is a more appropriate zone.
That was confirmed through
PDB1,
wasn't it? Rural lifestyle.
Yeah, there was an issue with a visitor accommodation overlay, I believe.
Yes, it was a visitor accommodation
subzone
was sought over that site, but then the provision for visitor accommodation subzones was not provided for in that zone.
Yes, yes.
So they couldn't have the subzone because it didn't exist in that zone.
Yeah, but yeah, it's complicated, I think, but it's covered by two different decisions.
Yes, and the subzones are only applied over the urban zones.
Yeah, there were three notified. I can't quite remember now the reasoning for it being uplifted, but.
So they couldn't have RVZ because in stage one.
Yes.
It wasn't on the table. They couldn't have BA because it's not appropriate for rural landscape, for rural lifestyle outside the urban zone. So the thought that's going through my mind is that the issue is not actually zoning what's there, it's the provision for any incremental development.
Yes. Yes, it is.
And if that's the case,
the business accommodation is just a discretionary activity in the rural lifestyle zone.
Yeah, so that, yeah.
And it's not non-compliant.
Yeah, true.
Why do you say if what's there isn't appropriate in the rural lifestyle zone when it's just a discretionary activity?
I go through that in my 42A, I think. It doesn't quite match the zone purpose. There's no living, there's no rural living on the site, I think is what I might say.
Okay. So by
13.9.
Yes.
The question that the line of thinking that I was going down was, if there were a stronger control, both at rule and policy level, over expansion of the existing operation, would RVZ be appropriate?
Yes.
Well,
I guess with a more supportive policy framework it would be.
Well, with a zone that supports RVZ.
Yeah.
And it would be within them.
And if it was site specific, it could make specific reference to traffic issues.
It could, yeah.
Okay.
Any more?
Nicole?
I think we've just got the same sort of package of concerns from the MLSOC that we've got in the other, in several of the other sites, that there hasn't been a proper assessment of landscape sensitivity or of the level of development that could be, that is sought across the site as control activity, being the 1,500 square metres, and the effect of that on rural amenity and values and rural character. Again, she seems to think that it might be possible to have an RVZ on that site, but we haven't got enough information to properly define that, either by more refined landscape sensitivity or something beyond that.
Yes.
And how many square metres of building could be controlled activity.
Yeah.
But apart from that, there don't seem to be any other outstanding concerns from what your witnesses on that.
That's
site.
Right. Yeah.
That's all for me.
Likewise. I wonder, I was going to, the next on your, we'll go off to Arcadia.
Arcadia.
What's that?
I've forgotten about that. Barnhill comment?
No.
So, I mean, this is another one that Mr. Millsop's looked at, and again, probably in, with much more stronger wording, she's, I mean, she supports the notified RVZ and the limitations of that, the mapping that was that's in the plan, and the limitations on civil development. But she, I mean, she goes so far as to say not that more work needs to be done, but even if the work was done, I think she would say that the level of the scale of development proposed by the submitter would not protect the outstanding, that would be a very high, it can be very high in outstanding natural landscape values of that site. The scale of development is too big, the locations of the development outside the areas she's identified as, or someone's identified as low sensitivity and not appropriate and wouldn't protect the values. So I think we know where the council's landscape architect stands on this. My question for you is, in terms of the existing, an existing baseline, and I know Ms. Scott touched on this in her legal submissions, what's your view about whether the approved structure plan, but not developed, can be used as an existing baseline for considering, not so much in a legal sense about that it can't be used for a plan change, but whether it's a development that could occur without this, that could occur alongside what is proposed with the zoning, and therefore acts as a could act to modify the landscape upon which the zoning needs to be considered.
Are you asking me whether the structure plan itself could be implemented on its own?
Well, that's a first question, yes.
Okay. I don't think it can, the structure plan. It's got a resource consent, but there's no activity associated with that resource consent. So,
okay, so it's only the structure plan that's got consent?
Yeah, well, yes, but also there is a subdivision. There's an approved subdivision that has got section 223 approval for 11 residential lots and an access lot.
Consistent with the structure plan?
Yes. I think...
largely?
Yeah, I think when the subdivision consent went through, there needed to be variation to the structure plan.
Not a completely different
it's generally the same as I understand it.
But apart from that, if it was still, with the zoning that's been proposed over the site at the moment, the activities that the structure plan enables envisage couldn't go ahead as of right?
They could, but not in the same areas as the structure plan. So
just maybe going back a bit, under the old zone, the old ODP, rural businesses zone,
yes.
Would that have allowed the activities under the structure plan to go ahead either as of right or controlled activities?
I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. Let me just... The structure plan... Hang on a minute, let me collect my thoughts here. The structure plan itself doesn't provide approval for anything to happen, as I understand it. The ODP... had permitted was the default activity status if something wasn't specified. And so it's slightly difficult to answer your question of what could be permitted because it's whatever's not listed, but residential is one of those things that wasn't listed, so by default it has permitted status under the operative district plan. Parking, loading and access, buildings, landscaping, commercial recreation activities and visitor accommodation are on the list of controlled activities, and there are some standards associated with that.
So I thought, I mean, that's probably sufficient to know that the ODP was relatively, well, like we've seen, was quite permissive,
yes,
of the activities. But I don't really think I need to fully understand. It had this strange structure plan,
yeah,
situation going on.
Yeah.
All right. So, in your view, should we or should we not take into account all that was enabled under the structure plan and the old zone now that we're considering a new situation with a new zone?
I think it shouldn't be given much weight at all because of the changes that have happened to the regional policy statement and the proposed district plan in the meantime, which have, generally speaking, tightened up quite significantly how we manage ONLs. And I think Ms. Malsop described the fact that her assessment, I think it was in 2011 or thereabouts, was for a controlled activity under quite a different framework to now. And if she did that assessment again, which she effectively has done in her landscape assessment for the notified RVZs, she comes to not an entirely different conclusion, I think, but now she has, now there's a framework in place for her to make slightly, for her assessment to have different results.
So whilst the owner of the land may have been making some progress, I suppose, towards an outcome under the old regime,
mm-hmm,
with some consents, albeit not necessarily all consents that were needed to actually put things on the ground.
Yeah.
In the meantime, the world has changed in a planning sense, that the ODP has changed, I mean, the ORPS has changed,
mm-hmm,
and that's flowed through to the strategic direction, which is getting quite confirmed now,
yeah,
and the landscape section and the strategic chapters, so that the inevitable result of that, in Ms. Nelson's mind, in evidence, is a much more tightened approach to the way development can occur on this particular site.
Yes. Yeah.
All right, that's all for me.
I have a piece of clarification. You said there's 11 lot subdivision.
Yes.
Are there approved building platforms on that, on those units?
No. And probably because they didn't need to be, because the buildings would have been permitted or are permitted under the ODP.
And so from landowners' position, they could proceed with the subdivision, but it's under a zone that makes residential development non-compliant?
Yes.
Is there a case, well, it's almost certainly in Mr. Vivian's evidence, but can you describe to me where is the 13-lot subdivision in relation to the homestead?
It's to the north, south, west. Sorry. So we can probably pull a plan up of it, but it incorporates the northwestern quarter.
I can visualise with that.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Because we tramped around it with Mr. Fain.
Right, yeah.
And so, in fact, he'd be better off with the rural side than.
Then they'd have a discretionary activity. Yeah, you're right. But, yeah.
If he wants to implement the subdivision.
Yeah.
So the question might be, would a rural zoning for that corner be in scope?
I'm not entirely sure that it would. It was notified as RVZ.
And they've sought recognition of the structure plan, which provides for that as residential. So in terms of Ms. Scott's test, the outer edge is a favourable zone for residential in areas identified as residential in the structure plan.
Yeah, the discretionary residential in the rural zone would be in the middle of the notified RVZ and what they've asked for in their submission.
That activity status would be, but whether the
zone.
Rural zone, which its purpose is not to provide residential development, would be within scope, I'm not sure, but I think the entire zone is probably a different question to that one rule.
Well, that might be right too.
But it's still an IL, I mean. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't be an easy consenting job. Although Ms. Melsop's evidence would suggest that it's not no hope either.
The
not
residential.
The residential. She hasn't supported any residential.
No.
As I understand the relationship between Ms. Melsop's landscape sensitivity analysis and overlaying the structure plan, the area where the residential is the area she has identified as lower landscape sensitivity, which is the area under the RVZ rules where the visitor accommodation and commercial recreation would be controlled.
Okay. Understand. Thank you. Anything else on Acadia?
Yeah, just the point of clarification, the residential development is envisaged under the 2011 structure plan.
No. Yeah.
So, in the 2011 structure plan, was reviewed by the then Lakes Environmental landscape architect, who suggested that the proposed level of development encouraged the structure plan could be absorbed without significant landscape effects, and is now saying, because it was one Helen Melsop, who's now saying that it's significantly detract from the natural cohesiveness and scenic quality views of Glenorchy.
Yeah, I think Miss Melsop addressed that this morning in her.
Apologies, I missed that.
Can I ask her a question about why she had a different view now for them?
Yeah, she's. I don't know, I'm sure it's in her statement somewhere, but she. That's not an entirely accurate summary of her whole assessment. So
yeah.
She did. She wasn't entirely favourable of the whole thing, and she has emphasised the fact that it was a controlled activity.
At that point.
Yeah, it kind of influenced things. So yeah, she hasn't kind of done a complete about face, as
no,
I understand
probably,
it.
No, that was just a point of view. I didn't, because I wasn't sure if the subdivision had, if there was a further subdivision.
Yeah.
All good, thank you.
Anything else on
Acadia?
Technically, your 42A is Windermere. We don't have any evidence from QAC, but can you just satisfy my curiosity? I couldn't find any RVZ land out there on the viewer.
It wasn't notified as RVZ. It got its zoning changed back to rural.
Well, you say it's currently split zones, with a portion being in PDP rural and the remaining area located within the notified RBZ.
Well, maybe that should say ODP RBZ. Sorry, where was that reference?
15.1. I was going cross-eyed trying to find it.
Be rezoned airport zone, or that the ODP will retain a similar zone as currently split zone, with a proportion being within the...
I've crossed out notified and written operative in my version of that. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I've got no idea. I'll check the maps. That doesn't sound right.
It's all rural, isn't it?
It is. I'm pretty sure we uplifted the whole rural visitor zone from the ODP and made the whole thing rural zone. Yeah, so that just must notified must be... I don't know why that says that. Sorry, I'll confirm that.
But answer is that appears to be an error in you, but I'm not saying that's a problem, just the point of clarification.
Yep.
Now, team, is that the end of our questions for Ms. Grace?
Yes, absolutely.
And we're starting to seem to have run out of witnesses. We could co-opt the gentleman down the rear.
Do a quick wave for you.
Who do you want to be? There's a choice of nine.
Would it be against the grain if you were giving evidence to the council?
For the distraction, they close this door.
Warm. Morning and afternoon too.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Grace, for an extended stay as Commissioner Dawson said. It's quite a mammoth effort given the number of sites you've had to look at in conjunction with principally the landscape team, but not limited to the landscape team. On that happy note, we will adjourn for the evening, and back same time, same channel tomorrow.
Thank you.